Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale University in 1962. He has taught at a number of colleges and universities, including the State University of New York, at Stony Brook and at Albany, the University of Vermont, and Sarah Lawrence College. He was a guest professor of political science at Howard University in 1987-88, a guest professor at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand, spring of 1989, and distinguished residence professor this spring at California State University, Northridge. And he asks that you don't call him at California State University, Northridge, because he is in the process of leaving this week. His books, which by the way are also available in the lobby at a table set up by the International Bookstore of Long Beach, include Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, The Politics of Mass Media, The Sword and the Dollar, Imperialism, Revolution, and the Arms Race, and the soon to be published at the end of this year, Make Believe Media, The Politics of the Entertainment Media. Professor Parenti, or Dr. Parenti, is also will soon be presenting a series of radio essays on KPFK titled Real History, which dissects the history taught in American schools and presents a real history, not their presented. KPFK will be presenting this programming on July 4th. His articles have appeared in The Nation, The Progressive, Political Affairs, American Political Science Review, The Journal of Politics, Politics and Society, Witness, National Catholic Reporter, Harvard International Review, Economic Notes, The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Science and Nature, Massachusetts Review, In These Times, and numerous other publications. He has lectured widely on college campuses and before religious labor, community, and public interest groups around the country on democracy and economic power, imperialism, the arms race, and U.S. interventionism, inventing reality, and democracy, revolution, and popular struggle, and related subjects. Okay, without further ado, I'd like to present our speaker tonight, Dr. Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. I knew there were this many people who might want to hear me. I didn't know there were this many who had $10 and willing to pay it. I've always thought that the ideas and issues and struggles that we waged were sacred, and here we now have visible evidence of it in these august surroundings. Which, much to my surprise, is a Methodist church, but it looks like the Catholic churches of my childhood. But, oh, I shouldn't even say that with all this thing, glass window. So I feel kind of at home here, and I hope you do, even if the acoustics are impossible. The subject is imperialism, the arms race, and the Bush hypocrisy. And I want to argue that those three things are very much alive and well. They're virulent, and they're closely interrelated. Now, the interesting thing about imperialism is that it's the most powerful force in the history of mankind, of humankind. Imperialism has been the most powerful, important force in the last 500 years. It's carved up the whole world. It's destroyed whole civilizations, whole peoples, whole regions. It's destroying our very atmosphere today, and yet it's never talked about. That is, you literally cannot talk about imperialism. You cannot get the word discussed on our mainstream media. You cannot talk about U.S. imperialism. If you say U.S. imperialism, they really think you're crazy. If you say 19th century British imperialism, they go, oh, yeah, right. Or Soviet imperialism, those were terms that were acceptable. But our commentators, our publishers, our editors, our writers, our columnists, our educators and such do not talk about imperialism. You can get a PhD in political science from Yale University and never once discuss imperialism, never once hear it mentioned. You're looking at Exhibit A, who did that very thing. It wasn't until many years later that I began to read about it on my own and realize what a horrendous, horrible story it is. Now, I'm not going to go through all that. I wrote a book about it, Sword and the Dollar, and I've talked about imperialism a lot, but I want to make a couple of points, namely that it goes on today. The imperialism, the horror of it, what the Dutch did in the West Indies, in the East Indies, I'm sorry, what the Belgians did in the Congo, what the Portuguese did in Mozambique and Angola, what the Germans did in Southwest Africa, what the Italians did in Libya and in Ethiopia, what the Americans did in Central America, Latin America, the Philippines, what the French did in North Africa, Indochina, is a horrendous history of murder, plunder, exploitation, enslavement. There's no way you could really exaggerate the horrors of it. And it is no less horrible for being largely untaught in our schools and unnoticed by our commentators. What the British did everywhere else, from Ireland to India to the Middle East to China, so forth. It's quite a story. But it goes on today. It continues today. Well, that's not true. The colonial world has won independence and all that. But what we have today is what we call neo-imperialism, what William Appleman Williams first called informal imperialism. And one of the earliest practitioners were the Americans. I'm writing a book right now on that period about the Spanish-American War, mostly because I'm doing an investigation of how the battleship Maine was blown up. And I've come to the conclusion it was blown up, and I have some new evidence on it. And you probably want to know who blew it up, don't you? Well, you'll have to read the book. It was the Americans who blew up the battleship Maine. But what was interesting is how there was a real struggle among the imperialists at that time between, and a lot of people who were identified as anti-imperialists were, as I read them closer, are not anti-imperialists, they were anti-annexationist. They didn't want colonies, and they talked about the vexatious colonies, that colonies were a bother, an expense. They didn't want colonies. What they did want, though, was access to those lands, to their markets, their resources, their cheap labor, and the like. Bankers wanted to move overseas with their idle capital. Manufacturers wanted to sell their surplus goods overseas. Others wanted to invest overseas, and so forth. So they didn't want to own it, because owning it often made them uncomfortable. These colonies were made up of people of mixed bloods, the wrong religious background at times, troublesome, far-off places. So they began to practice what today is called neo-imperialism. And when I was a kid, you could look at a globe, and you could see all the pink on the globe, and that was the British Empire. And you said, this is the empire upon which the sun never set. And we used to marvel at all that pink all over the globe. Now, the American Empire, you can't see. It's not there as far as direct possession. But you have this neo-imperialism, and we first practiced it in Cuba, where we said, look, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, but we're going to give you your independence, because we fought. That was one of the things we told the American people why we were fighting this war. And you're going to get your independence, and you're going to get your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue, and it's going to have a star, a white star in it. You get only one star because you're a little island. And you're going to have a very nice constitution. It'll be very nice because we wrote it for you. And you have your own president and your own currency. You can put Jose Marti on your pesos. You don't have to have George Washington unless you want him. And all we do in exchange is we will control your imports, your exports, your sugar industry, your tobacco industry, your rum industry, your oil refineries, your tourist trade, and everything else. And your foreign policy. So neo-imperialism is the expropriation of the land, the labor, the markets, and the resources of one country by the economic elites of another country on terms that are highly favorable to those elites. That's the crucial point. It's not just another form of investment. Why don't they go invest in Ohio then? They can find people in Ohio to put together their computers and their electric rods and make their baby powder and cosmetics. They can find people in California to do that. Why do they got to go to El Salvador to do it? because it's on terms that are very highly favorable to them. It's capitalism triumphant. And when people talk about capitalism as the system that works, they're right. That system works, and you ought to see it at its most triumphant, where it really realizes itself, where it's most effective, where it's most successful. And it's not most successful in West Germany. It's not most successful in Sweden or in the United States even. It's most successful in El Salvador and in Indonesia and in South Korea and now more and more in Poland. And you'll see it in these places. That's where it's most successful, because that's where the rate of accumulation is 200 and 300% higher. The profits, we're talking about profits. We're talking about millions of dollars. And that's why they go there. It's not to uplift those people. It's not to bring them the benefits of civilization. They go there because they're going to make a bigger and faster buck over there. And that's the only reason they go. And when you ask them, that's when they tell you finally. When you ask them to do anything else, that's when they say, we're not in the business of cleaning up the environment. We're in the business of making money. Don't take my word for it. Listen to David Roderick, president of U.S. Steel. He made a very extraordinary comment several years ago. He said, U.S. Steel is not in the business of making steel. I said, at last somebody said it. They're not there because you need steel or you need this or that. They're there. He said, U.S. Steel is in the business of making profits, of making money. That's what they make. In fact, it's so true that they changed their name from U.S. Steel to USX. And when I was a kid in algebra class, we learned X is an unknown quantity. He said, what do you make? What do you make? We make X. We make money. That's what we make. So that's why they go into these countries. And when they're in these countries, there's a comprador class that sells out their country, that sells out the birthright of their country. Chile is selling out its forests, its rainforests. The Chilean fascists said to the companies, come on in, cut them down as quick and as fast as you can, take what you want, just give us our cut. Come on in. My friends, come in. There's no occupational safety laws here. There's no environmental protection laws. There's no minimum wage. There's no legal labor unions, or the unions are kept in line by our troops and our police, who are trained and equipped and paid for by you. Thank you. And the purpose of all this is to make the world safe for the people in column A. Now, all the people of the world are divided into those who are in column A and those who are in column B. And the ones in column A make their money from dividends, principally, interest on bonds and securities, land and mineral royalties, capital gains, rents, and other forms of investment speculation. The other 97% of humankind is in column B, and they get their income from wages, salaries, and pensions, primarily. You might have a little CD and you get a little interest on that too, but primarily they make their money off their own labor. And that's what it's all about. And that's what they do. They fight and they kill and they use death squads and they perpetrate coups and they arm mercenary armies and they bomb poor neighborhoods in Panama and they do all these things because they are keeping the world safe for the people in column A. If you know that, and you know nothing else about international relations, you know more than if you know everything else, but you don't know that, which is what most political scientists do, the second category. Now, neo-imperialism works for the benefit of the people in column A, but it's paid for primarily by the people in column B. We pay for it with our taxes. We pay for it with the export of our jobs. We pay for it with the loss of civilian services and human services and social wage that are needed for a better, decent society here, because that money's got to be used on missiles and it's got to go to the generals in El Salvador and Chile and places. We pay for it with the ecological devastation that takes place in those countries. We pay for it in the overpriced goods that the cartels then ship back here. We'd be able to pay a much more reasonable price if we were buying from the country itself. And of course, the people in the third world suffer even more. It's easy to lose sight of that. Especially, you know, every Agent Orange case that makes the media is about the Vietnam veterans who are out there in the helicopters, and some of the stuff came up and they're suffering now from cancer. Well, you ought to see what's happening to the Vietnamese. I was just, yesterday I was at the University of, Syracuse University, and I was talking to a professor, Sungang Kwang. He's a Korean, but he's doing a study of the devastation in Vietnam, and he showed me photographs that are so horrendous and so horrible of newborn babies in Vietnam with legs and feet coming out of their chest, born with 3 feet, 3 eyes, totally distorted. I mean, absolute aberrations, absolute horrors, alive. And he said the genetic damage and the ecological damage in Vietnam is terrible, he said. And while they thought about the veterans in the helicopters who were getting the stuff that was floating up, they forget that the other 99% of it was being dumped down on the people there. So that gives you an idea of the suffering that goes on among all of us and among all of them. And of course, they suffer much more than we do, but it also affects the quality of our lives. Now, this neo-imperialism needs a global military machine to defend that status quo and to make the world safe for capital penetration and capital accumulation. We're given a lot of other reasons as to why the U.S. is everywhere and must be everywhere. We're told it is to defend democracy. Well, that we know is not true, because we defend some of the worst tyrannies that ever existed on the face of the earth, and we have overthrown democracies. Those democracies where leaders may not have even been leftist or communist or that all that radical. They could just be populist nationalists. But they were doing some things. The democracy was beginning to work too well, and it was beginning to infringe upon the prerogatives of imperialism. And it was that point that it had to be crushed. Henry Kissinger made that point about Chile. He said, if it's a matter of choosing between democracy or saving democracy or saving the economy, we must save the economy. Now, that's the closest Henry Kissinger has ever come to uttering the truth. It's a half-truth, but it's a half-truth. If he had said, if it's a choice between saving democracy and saving the capitalist economy, when we must save the capitalist economy, he would have had the whole truth. Because, in fact, under Allende, unemployment had gone down, inflation had gone down, and there had been a shift in the gross national income from those people who make their money from dividends and interest and land and mineral royalties and capital gains to those people who make their money from wages and salaries. That actually the Chilean buying power had come up, standard of living had come up, and the productivity had gone up, and so forth. And that had to be stopped. That's what was happening. So it's not to defend democracy. Democracy is a secondary condition. There are times they will prop up democracies if that democracy is a good legitimator for the existing social relations. The goal, the ideal goal, and it's the CIA goal, is to create forms, democratic forms in countries, Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Guatemala, where in effect the working class is excluded from the politics. Very much the model, the first model of that is the United States, where the working class, where the mass of people are excluded from the electoral process itself. Not that they can't vote, they can vote, but there's generally nothing to vote for. There's no candidate that is actually representing their class interest. There's no candidate that actually is representing the needs of the society, the human ecological needs, the needs of the children, the needs of working people, the needs of people to have a better life. There's no political force, no electoral presence for that force. There may be a person here or there who talks about it and a bill can get through and all that, but for the most part, that's how you do it. So you have the legitimating democratic reforms, and those become very important, the legitimating forces. So you can go around, you go to Latin America, people know those governments don't represent their interests, but you talk to students here, and they believe they're free. They believe their elected representatives represent them. And so it's a very valuable thing. Now for that, so that's really it. They will sometimes go for democracy if they can legitimate. Dominican Republic is a very good example of that. The Chilean democracy that's emerging today is a joke and an example of that. A democracy where the military is, as you know, independent of the government. The military sets its own budget. The military can veto certain laws that the government passes. The military totally defends its own prerogatives. Well, we're told that we are in all these countries and all that to defend the economic well-being of the United States. I've heard this from congressmen. I've heard members of Congress say, well, you want to change all that, you know, it's going to affect our standard of living. Again, I don't believe that's true. The oil, the coffee, the beef, whatever else, would cost less from these countries than it does from the U.S. cartels. Those countries which have nationalized their oil holdings do not sell their oil at any more expensive price than Exxon does. It's said that we have to be in these countries for national security reasons, to defend the U.S. against hostile regimes. If we defend only the U.S., we'll someday have only the U.S. left to defend, it is said. But these regimes aren't hostile. They don't threaten our national security. They all want friendly relations. They all want to trade with us. They all want to have friendly economic, diplomatic relations. They all want an end to the economic, technological, and trade embargoes that are imposed upon them by the U.S. They're no threat. The Dominican Republic never invaded the U.S. The U.S. has invaded the Dominican Republic many times. Cuba has never invaded the U.S., but Cuba has been invaded and attacked by the U.S. a number of times. And Panama, and Nicaragua, and Vietnam, and Cambodia, and Laos, and Libya, and El Salvador, and Guatemala, and East Timor, and Zaire, and the Philippines, and Angola, and Mozambique, just to mention a few in recent years who have felt the brunt of U.S. military force, either directly or with mercenary forces, or indirectly through surrogate forces that were trained, equipped, and financed by the U.S. None of those countries has attacked or interfered with the United States, but they have all been victims of U.S. military or CIA military power and repression. We're told we have to now go into these countries to fight the narco-terrorists. That's the biggest joke yet, isn't it? In Peru and Colombia, and as a Peruvian said to me, they're giving all the money to the wrong people. They're going in and giving it to the military. Well, who the hell do you think is in on these narcotic trades in Peru and Colombia and Guatemala? You think the military isn't in on it? Ramon Rodriguez was before Senator Curry's committee investigating this. Do you all remember that testimony? Well, they had him and they said, what are you doing now, Ramon Rodriguez? He said, I'm doing 20 years in prison for laundering drugs. See, they catch some of these guys sometimes, even ones who are connected. I was surprised that he's in prison, because Ramon Rodriguez knows Felix Rodriguez. And Felix Rodriguez is a good friend of George Bush's. And they said, how much did you launder a week? He said, about $10 million in cash a week. Can you imagine the size of this guy's suitcases? I brought it in and out of these countries. And they said, what countries besides Panama, Panama was the really bad guy, did you do this in? And he said, oh, Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, Ecuador, the Dominican Republic, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, didn't mention Cuba or Nicaragua. And he said, who did you deal with in these countries? He said, with executive leaders in all the countries, and in a lot of cases also military leaders in these countries. That's rather remarkable. And our media, which is always falsely accused of being sensationalistic, falsely accused. There are all sorts of sensational, utterly sensational, mind-boggling stories that are not touched at all. Our media hasn't splashed that all over the front pages. And Senator D'Amato, my hero from New York, he's got such a poise about him. He said, how did you get in and out of customs with all that money? And Rodriguez said, well, really, Senator, you don't go through customs, you know, when you got $10 million on you. they bring a helicopter, limousines, you know, you're treated differently. Said, ah, yeah. We are after the narco-terrorists, says that vibrant, vital George Bush. The narco-terrorists. He sets you on fire, doesn't he, when he talks? He goes, go. Oh, Georgie, do it, Georgie. And we're going to get that Noriega. He abused an American woman. This is the defender of American women. This is the old kitchen table, clothes hanger job, abortion boy. He's a defender now of the American woman. This is news to me. And he's got to go get that drug dealer because he can't find any in Miami. He can't find any in L.A. or Harlem. He's got to go to Panama to go find drug dealers, big drug dealers. That's where they are. And we'll get them. I think Panama is a perfect example of the Bush hypocrisy. We went in to get Noriega. Well, we already got Noriega, you might have noticed, months ago. And we're still in there. And what are we doing? We're doing something more than getting Noriega. We're destroying the populist nationalist government. There was a leftist military in Panama, of a sort, a kind of Huey Long leftist, you know. They didn't nationalize any of the businesses, but they shook them down. They said, you can come in here, you just give us this cut. And they put a little in the deduct box, as Huey used to do for the boys, to keep them happy. But they also put out a few social programs, some of which were pretty good. And they were forming a populist nationalist consciousness. And that's why we went into Panama. And that's why we're still there. We've broken the Democratic Revolutionary Party and closed all their organizations. We've arrested over 1,000 people. There's a commission that's gone down now, independent commission, Ramsey Clark, Paul O'Dwyer, who's no radical, William Schapp, and others. And they've been finding that there's been thousands of people are held on the charge of, quote, impeding the renewal of the powers of the state. That has a nice little Nazi ring to it, doesn't it? And they are in jail. They're facing from 5 to 20 years imprisonment, but none of them has gone on trial yet. They include former government officials, members of the Democratic Revolutionary Party, trade union leaders, farm workers and farm leaders, scholars, intellectuals, teachers, including professors from the University of Panama City, and journalists. The Panamanian media has been suppressed. You don't hear about that now, media. When the Sandinistas cut 3 columns out of La Prensa, a newspaper that was paid for by the CIA, that would be all over the media. Sandinistas suppressing freedom of the press. But you haven't heard a word about that. They haven't gotten around to discussing that in Panama. Escolástico Calvo, if I pronounce his name right. Calvo is the publisher of La Republica. He ran graphic descriptions of the death and the destruction caused by the U.S. invasion in La Republica. Well, he had his offices raided, robbed, and shut down, and Calvo is now in jail. He's been held now for over 5 months, and no charges against him. The new government is composed into the officials who are running this new government and making it all work and whatever else and in charge is composed mostly of U.S. military and State Department officials. The puppet president that's been set up, Endara, is a wealthy corporate lawyer. He's a direct stockholder and business partner of one Carlos Elata, a business tycoon who was arrested in Georgia last April for conspiring to import tons of cocaine into the United States. They didn't go in to get the drug dealers. They put the drug dealers in power. Vice President Arias reportedly amassed fortunes in contraband goods, including hard drugs. The other vice president, Guillermo Ford, has connected to banks in Miami that have laundered huge sums of drug money. That's the democracy that the Bush hypocrisy has set up. Now, there are a lot of other reasons. We went in to safeguard the canal. Well, that's a lot of baloney. The canal was never in danger. The Panamanians had no interest in interfering with the canal traffic. they had a real interest in demonstrating that it was safe. We went in to defend American lives. That's a lot of baloney. There are no lives that were in danger unless you drive a jeep through a Panamanian military checkpoint right in front of their military headquarters, which you couldn't miss, a checkpoint you couldn't miss, and you go right through it, and then you get shot, and one of our soldiers was shot then. But if you're going to go invade if any country can invade any country where foreigners are in danger, if other countries could invade the U.S. every time a foreigner is killed on the streets of Washington, D.C. or New York or Chicago or wherever, they have quite an array of expeditionary forces roaming up and down this continent, wouldn't they? Now, all those reasons are false reasons, are contrived reasons, are lies. Lies and lies. It's government by lie, governed by deceit. And if they got to keep lying and deceiving, what are they hiding? See, because it's wrong to say, as often happens, that the reasons given are irrational. And therefore, having refuted the irrational reasons, we conclude that the policy is irrational. Therefore, it doesn't make sense. But there are rational reasons. And the rational reasons are what I said. The rational reason is to protect the open door, to make sure that those people do not shift anything from column A to column B, to protect the process of capital penetration and accumulation, to make the world safe for the people in column A, to make the world safe for the class that George Bush represents and belongs to and loves and defines all other values, including freedom, decency, democracy, everything, from the perspective of that class, to protect the system that serves that class, and to protect the military power, the installations and the bases and the force and the ability to deliver force and violence that protects and terms that system. So you have to protect the process of enforcement and whatever else for that system. And if you know that, then you move from a liberal complaint to a radical analysis. There's a difference between a liberal complaint about how foolish and irrational our U.S. policy is. There's a difference between a liberal complaint that talks about these symptoms and bemoans them and says, we have no right to be in Panama. That's a stupid, bad policy. It's not enough to denounce the policy. You also have to analyze and ask, why? If it's so stupid and bad, are they really so much more stupid than you, Mr. Liberal? The fact that you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean you should assume that they don't know what they're doing. And if you move from a liberal complaint to a radical analysis, which shows that the policy is actually doing what it is supposed to be doing, and it is protecting the interest that and promoting the interest that it's supposed to be. Another reason given to justify this global military machine is Soviet global threat, the Soviet challenge, the communist bloc. Well, I used to argue that, in fact, if the communist countries disappeared, the Soviet Union disappeared, I think I might have even mentioned that in The Sword and the Dollar. I argued that if those countries disappeared, we would still need this military bloc, not thinking that, in fact, they would disappear. And in fact, they have been. This communist bloc has dissolved before our very eyes, and it will continue to dissolve. And yet, has the U.S. global military machine dissolved? No, it is not dissolving. We still need that military machine, and we need it for two reasons. First, it not only protects capital investment and profits, but it itself is a valuable source of capital investment and profit. It has a new and endless source of capital investment. It has a continual self-obsolescence and self-regeneration. New weapon systems are always coming along. It has a guaranteed market and contracts. It has guaranteed cost overruns. It has non-competitive bids. The price that the contractor names is the price he gets. It has subsidized research and development. It has subsidized equity from the Pentagon, up to sometimes 70-80% of the whole enterprise will be paid for by them. It has the highest profits of any form of investment in America. The second reason for that global military machine is what we've just been talking about all the while, global imperialism. That is, we still have to make sure and protect the status quo all around the world. And that's why you see some very interesting things happening now. You find that there are going to be no cuts in naval nuclear forces, no cuts in conventional weapons. Admiral Trost says the U.S. is a mercantile power. It cannot cut its merchant forces. By that logic, the Soviets are a land power. They should not have to cut their land forces. No, we all can cut our land forces. And the Soviets, I think, are seeing this quite correctly as an evasion of any comprehensive de-escalation. The United States has 25% of its strategic nuclear force land-based. It has 75% sea and air-based in SLBMs and a whole bunch of other kinds of missiles, many of which are intermediate and tactical, supposedly, but they're so close and they're so around the rim of the mainland that they can reach Soviet soil and they should be counted as strategic. The Soviets are the opposite. They have 75% of their strategic force is land-based and only 25% is air and sea-based. And that 25% is poorly mobilized because they are penalized by geography. They have only two choke points, the North Sea and the Japanese Sea, heavily patrolled and tracked. They don't have rings of bases all around, Air Force bases all around the world, too, for their bombers. So the U.S. is pushing now for a 50% reduction in land-based missiles only and land forces only. Admiral Trust, as I said, Chief of Naval Operations, made these points. First, the U.S. Navy has more to do than just defend us from the Soviet Union. I thought that was a fascinating comment. For 40 years, they were saying it was for the Soviet Union. You know, Russia's going to get your mama. We have to do this. He said, no, we have other things to do. That wasn't that important anyway. We have other things now. Well, what else, Admiral Trost? I said, coming to the edge of my seat with excitement and anticipation. And Trost went on, he said, we have to show the flag. Show the flag, that's interesting. We used to call that gunboat diplomacy. And we have to, he went on, give logistics support for U.S. forces in regional conflicts. That's what I call making the world safe for capital penetration and making sure no alternative systems develop which might begin to shift money, food, clothing, and the forms of production from column A to column B. And Admiral Trost went on, he said, restrictions on our naval forces would violate international law regarding freedom of the seas. I said, wait a minute. What do you mean regarding international freedom of the seas? You mean freedom of the seas says that you can carry nuclear weapons and do whatever you want and go anywhere and menace any country? That's the way they're reading the international law now. The LA Times of December 2nd, 1989, I quote, administrative official who says, secure sea lanes are as vital to the U.S. as the Soviets' internal railroad lines are to the Kremlin. You see, it's a trade-off. You can protect your railroad lines in your country, and we can protect the sea lanes in our globe, you see. And these sea lanes must be defended so that we can get U.S. reinforcements wherever they may be needed. They're talking about the need to maintain repressive force and violence against those Sandinos, and today's his birthday, against the Ho Chi Minhs, against the people of history who have tried to fight back against imperialism and have tried to reclaim their country. Defense Secretary Cheney, quote, I have absolutely no interest to believe that it is, oh, I'm sorry, I have absolutely, yeah, that's the way it is, that's what he said. I have absolutely no interest to believe that it is in our interest to enter into any kind of arms control measure involving naval weapons. Now, naval weapons just doesn't mean guns and aircraft carriers. They're talking about the Trident II D-5 first strike missiles. They're talking about nuclear strategic weapons. That's what they're talking about. They're talking about intermediate range missiles that could hit Soviet soil if you're in the Eastern Mediterranean or in the North Sea. President Bush, quote, the U.S. Navy is defender of freedom throughout the world. Well, sea power means interventionist power. It means regional conflict power. It means counterinsurgency power. It means overthrow other governments power. It means support column A power. Now, what we've had also is a lot of talk about peace dividends and the end of the arms race. It's unfortunate a lot of people think the arms race is over. Bush's budget director, Richard Darman, he spoke of a peace dividend that might reach $50 billion. That's an exciting amount, $50 billion. The federal budget is $1 trillion. So what is $50 billion? Is that 5%? 5%. Wow! The mind boggles. But it's not true, by the way. Not even that pittance is forthcoming. They've often thrown us scraps in the past, and now they're throwing us imaginary scraps. The 1991 military budget has gone up from 1990 from $298 billion to $303 billion is what Bush is pushing. Funding for Star Wars has gone up in the new budget 22%, $4.8 billion. Star Wars, which even Bush administration officials, including Dan Quayle, said isn't going to really work. Dan Quayle said it, which makes me think it might work. I forgot. God, I just suddenly... Let's skip over that one and move on. The B-2 bombers, funding for the B-2 bombers are up 29%. They tell you they're going to cut. They're going to cut from 65 to 43. You go, oh, wow. But they're not telling you they're building 43 new ones, and that's bringing the funding of that program up. They're increasing it. The MX missiles is up 64% to $3 billion. Two Sea Wolf submarines will cost, just two of these submarines will cost $3.5 billion. That's more money than spent on all the daycares, all the women's infant children programs, nutritional programs in America for women, infants, and children put together. For those two submarines, the cruise missile is up 47% in the new budget. The Trident submarine is up 14%. The Trident II missiles are up 13%. These are strategic first strike weapons. The Continental Forces, the Soviets will reduce their Continental Forces to 195,000. The U.S. will maintain 225,000. So the U.S., that sea power, has a larger Continental Force in Europe than the Soviets that is in Europe. Well, they're closing military bases, they're cutting troops to continue this buildup of strategic forces, and since the military budget, the rate of escalation has come down, it is much harder. If they had their way, this new budget would be 320, and the next one would be 350, and within 3 or 4 years, we'd be at $400 billion. And the rate of growth has had to slow down, but it's still growing. And also it's growing another way in that they're shifting. They're getting rid of some of the fat. They're closing a lot of the bases, many of which were pork barrel. Of the 21 bases they're closing, 19 are in districts of Democratic Congress people. So it's a partisan hit list. The U.S. is also developing the TASM. The TASM is a tactical air-to-surface missiles. A lot of publicity about how they're not going to deploy upgraded short-range nuclear missiles. They will not deploy upgraded nuclear-tipped artillery. You know why? Because those short-range missiles and artillery can only reach East Germany and Czechoslovakia. There's no reason anymore now that East Germany and Czechoslovakia are moving swiftly to right-wing governments. Even then, Bush had to be pressured by West Germany, because the West Germans resisted the deployment of the short-range nuclear missiles. The air-launched TASMs, or tactical air-to-surface missiles, will be more acceptable to Western Europeans, U.S. officials said, because they reached the Soviet Union. The artillery and the short-range didn't, but these air-launched ones will. So this is the way they're talking. The TASMs are slated for deployment by 1994 or 1995, according to the New York Times, May 9th. The West Germans are worried that it might send the wrong signal to the Soviets and would deter reunification. How could it send the wrong signal to the Soviets? NATO leaders, quote, the NATO leaders unanimously accepted by all member nations that there should be no denuclearization either of Europe nor Germany. Same New York Times citation. So I think we ought to catch that and be cool on that and be aware of that. Take the foreign aid. Take the non-nuclear. $15 billion of our tax money goes to foreign aid. Now, foreign aid conjures up images of running water in poor villages and rural health clinics. Well, almost $5 billion of that is used to subsidize arms sales. Almost $4 billion of that is used to finance other military infrastructures like leasing of overseas bases and such. About $2.5 million of that goes for development assistance, most of which never reaches the poor of the third world. Let's look at some other things about peace dividends in the new Bush budget. The Environmental Protection Agency, frozen at last year's level. The EPA does such a lousy job. And one of their first lines of excuse is, we just don't have the personnel. We just can't do it all. And so their budget has been frozen at last year's level. Federal retirement programs cut by $3 billion. Medicare cut by $5.5 billion. Not after allowing for inflation, just cut. And that includes then the other cut that comes with inflation. The Children's Nutrition Program cut $400 million. You know why such a small amount? Because it's such a small program. Despite the fact that of the 34 million people living below poverty, the majority of them are children. And of the 12 million rock bottom, the majority of those suffer from very real malnutrition in the United States. And they cut $400 million. They saved $400 million. Which is what the Pentagon spends in about 13 hours. That's what they cut. The mass transit funding in this age of ecological disaster, what we need is more privatized polluting automobiles. Mass transit funding is cut 19.8%. Funding for clean water treatment facilities have been cut 18%. Of the $16 billion in domestic and military spending cuts, 80% was from domestic budget cuts. Well, public sector spending takes us down the slippery slope of socialism, except for defense spending. That's the view of the right-wingers who control. That's the view of the extremists who are in power. Remember that. Anybody ever calls us extremists, you remind them that we're not extremists. You want to feed children, there's nothing extreme about that. You want to defend the environment, that's nothing extreme. The extremists are already in power, and they're doing very extreme things. But it's not entirely true that they turn their backs completely on socialism. They like a certain kind of socialism, a socialism for the rich. The minute you talk about the diseconomies of capitalism, they cry socialism. Years ago, I remember, it was discovered the poverty of Appalachia. Appalachia was discovered as an area that the nation had forgotten. It was called the Forgotten People of Appalachia. History has passed them by. We have forgotten them. And I thought, nobody forgot them. The Mellons and the Morgans and the Rockefellers didn't forget Appalachia. They were down there mining the coal, and they made millions of dollars in profit. Only the people are poor. But Appalachia wasn't forgotten. But it's the forgotten, and it was called the shame of the nation. We Americans are going to have to do something about those people. And I said, why is it our shame? Isn't it the shame? Nobody said it's the shame of the coal mining companies. It's the shame of the Wall Street investors. They are the ones who impoverished and plundered those areas. Well, when it comes to those diseconomies, we get socialists. We're all in this together. We have to help Appalachia. You see, it's a socialist form. Socialism for environmental devastation. You hear these chief executive officers of corporations say, well, if the public wants to clean up all this pollution, the public is going to have to pay for it. There they go, talking socialism again. On certain things, they're very socialistic. They say, you have to pay for that. It's the public. It's a public thing. Public sector has to take care of that. The private sector can't do it. It's too big a job for the private sector. We're only big enough to pollute the place. We're not big enough to clean it up. There's socialism. We have socialism right here in this state. I got here in Southern California just in time to get sprayed by malathion. Socialism for malathion. The minute they find one little bug somewhere, an exotic pest, the state declares a state of emergency, and the taxpayers pay for all that spraying to kill all that organic farming that goes on to kill one or two bugs as agribusiness, hundreds of millions of dollars for these chemical companies. Where's the free market? Hey, agribusiness, free market, risks, you take your own chances, get out there, entrepreneur, you fight your own bugs. You got bugs, you work with the bugs. Why? Why do we get socialistic suddenly and we have to use the public treasure to take care of your products? We have socialism for Jesse Helms. Jesse Helms, who wants to go after wasteful things like the infants feeding program and health care for the disabled and whatever else. Jesse Helms, the little fascist senator from North Carolina, he fights for tobacco subsidies. He talks socialism. He says, we're talking about human beings out there. Talking about human beings out there in North Carolina and other places who are growing that tobacco. And so we have to have export subsidies for tobacco to make sure people get cancer. That's socialism for cancer. Socialism for the tobacco industry. Socialism for the electronics industry. Socialism for the telecommunications industry. The building of all those satellites were done by the people of the United States. That was done by public funding. That was all that research, all that development was done by the government. Industry can't do it. Industry isn't big enough. Industry's just big enough to then come along and own it and take it over for a song and make profits off it. There's socialism for medical schools. Every doctor in America... Every doctor in America, including the ones who rant against socialized medicine, are products in part of socialistic public subsidies. Every medical school in America has the benefit of federal and state subsidies from the taxes of millions of working poor, many of whom then cannot afford the services of the doctors they have helped train. We have socialism to finance the transition from socialism to capitalism in Eastern Europe. The American taxpayer has to come in there, and aid is going to Poland and Hungary. It's not going to Poland or Hungary. It's going into something that George Bush calls the Enterprise Fund, and it will be used to subsidize the transitions to the free private market. Hey, but if it's going to be a free private market, why don't you let the free private marketeers go and do it on their own? Well, we need some socialism for that, so that they can go in and buy up. And by the way, Eastern European socialism subsidizes this transition because these things are going to be bought up at giveaway prices. Well, they say, well, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? I say, yeah, I do. Yeah, that sure is. What else is it? As I've said before, and maybe some of you heard, you can talk about anybody else planning and manipulating and pursuing and promoting their own self-interests. But the minute you suggest that the people who own the mines, the mills, the factories, the banks, and everything else in this country, that they consciously pursue these interests and may hide them and don't tell you and constantly represent this as being part of your interest, the minute you say that, it's called a conspiracy theory. And in fact, the alternative to a conspiracy theory is a somnambulist theory, which is that they just walk around in their sleep. And David Rockefeller gets up in the morning and says, I don't know what my interests are because I'm not a conspiracy nut, so I don't care. And he says to somebody from Morgan Guarantee, he says, oh, you don't like unions too? I don't like unions either. Why don't you like them? You bust them? I don't like them. I just, the way they sound, union, it sounds like onion. It sounds too much like onion, so I bust unions. Why do you bust unions? I bust them in El Salvador too. I bust them in Argentina because I feel the Argentine cultural temperament is such that there shouldn't be unions there either. What about you? Yeah, that's why I do it also. Yeah, that's right. Has nothing to do with self-interest. We don't conspire for our self-interest. We just do these things. We've had a media, and we have people on the left who believe that the President of the United States was that way. They believe that Ronald Reagan was that way. They believe that this guy was just a dodo walking around. Some dodo. He destroyed the progressive income tax. He did a redistribution of the gross national income from column B to column A of hundreds of billions of dollars. He spent $2.5 trillion on the military. And people are laughing at him. And he goes, shucks, I guess I'm just a whole funny guy here. And Iran-Contra, he even took it himself as a cloak. He said, I guess I get a little mixed up. I didn't have hands-on leadership here. I guess you can complain about my kind of laid-back style of doing it. I mean, he actually picks up the somnambulist theory of this to hide the fact that there's a conspiracy, that they went behind the backs of the people and the Congress and the Constitution and the laws of the land, and he starts doing that. I'm doing this research on the Spanish-American War, and I hear William McKinley, that famous meeting he has with the Methodist ministers, where he said, I didn't even know where the Philippines are. It's very funny. Golly, he said to them. And they said, Mr. President, we're slaughtering a lot of people in the Philippines. We're burning villages and we're killing thousands of men, women, and children. The rivers are clogged with bodies and American soldiers are killing all these people, and we're hunting Aguinaldo's army, and we're doing this and we find the people support Aguinaldo's army, so we're killing all the people too. And what's why I thought we started this war against Spain to liberate the Cuban people from Spanish tyranny. Why did we go into the Philippines, and why are we killing all the people we were supposed to liberate? And what was your plan? Why did you do this? He said, oh, shucks, I didn't have any plan. When I heard about the Philippines and all that, I had to go look on a map to find out where those little buggers were, he said. That's what he said. It's a very famous, it's quoted. I'm going to quote it in my book. But that's not true, because I said, wait a minute. 2 years before, in September of 1897, about 5 months before the battleship Maine was even sent to Havana, Assistant Secretary of Navy Teddy Roosevelt spent 2 days with President McKinley. 1 day with him dining, and the next day out horseback riding, and talked about. And I got Teddy's letters where he says, we talked about Cuba, we talked about the Caribbean, we talked about the Philippines. I said, he knew about the Philippines. He'd heard of them before. He must have heard of them when Teddy said, I'm going to send Commodore Dewey and the Navy to the Philippines. He might have said, where are those Philippines, Teddy? Oh, Pacific. And maybe he didn't have a precise idea of the location, but he'd heard of the Philippines. In fact, everybody in America had. But that kind of stuff, you see, is to say, there's no conspiracy. It's just happenstance, and we get up one morning, and we acquired an empire in a fit of absent-mindedness. Remember that quote? The British Empire, which British imperialists love to say, the British Empire was acquired in a fit of absent-mindedness. Can you imagine a whole global empire absent-mindedly sending all these troops to plunder all these lands and killing all these people? Well, it's a hypocrisy. That's the Bush hypocrisy. And it's said that hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. That's not true. That saying that has been around for centuries, I will now refute it. I just declare it's not true. That vice never pays any tribute to virtue. Hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to power. That is, hypocrisy is the tribute that they pay to us. They have to lie to us, and every time they lie to us, they're admitting that they are ruling not in our interest, not in the interest of the Cuban people, who they are now targeting as their next target, and not in the interest of the people anywhere in the world. They're fighting for the interest of their own class and their own interests. Knowing this, we also understand that we have some kind of power, and we must be aware of that power. And so we have to keep talking out, expose that hypocrisy, do not get caught up in the idea that the arms race is over, do not get caught up in the idea that there are peace dividends around the corner, but it doesn't mean we mustn't fight for the end of the arms race, and we mustn't fight for the peace dividends. There's the only thing that keeps them from doing what they would really want to do completely to us is our ability to struggle and fight back and to organize. The only thing that keeps them from reducing us to the level of living that Salvadorans are living, and they are reducing our standard of living anyway, but it's our ability to fight back. And that's the fight that has to go on. Hypocrisy is the tribute which vice pays to power. And that power is going to get strong enough to expose that hypocrisy and defeat and destroy that vice. Thank you. Well, it was a nonpartisan audience we have here tonight. I have a question period now. If anybody would like to pose questions, please do. We'll just have a few, okay? Oh, is there a videotape we're doing of this? Because oh, there's the tape. Because the light is killing me. We still need that light on. All right. Okay. Okay. This. We didn't need the light anymore. Good. Thanks.
You and George Bush both attended Yale. I understand.
Sit down. The question is, you and George Bush both attended Yale? Snicker, snicker, snicker. No, first of all, we didn't. George Bush was a Yalie, and I was just a graduate student at Yale. Graduate students have no state. We're just people who come in, and that's when you hear Yale graduate, that's the undergraduate school. That's the people who go on to the banks and brokerage firms, and those are the Yalies. And people who go to graduate school are not Yalies. We don't come out saying, I'm a Yale man, you see. We just get our graduate training there.
I heard on the radio that he was involved in some kind of student society, the Cross and Bones.
Skull and Bones is it's called a secret society. Yale has, the undergraduates have secret societies.
And I've heard some pretty uncomplimentary things from other sources that it was a satanic society or conspiracy
still. No.
Can you elaborate? Is there any information available?
Oh, no, that's not satanic cults. The secret societies at Yale are just very elite groups that their membership is secret. They have usually 15, 20 people in them, and they're usually elite people. They're people who are linked and go on to do creative things together in the CIA, Wall Street, and in the executive branch and in the Council for Foreign Relations and all that. And they start at the Yale level. You see, they consciously, people who argue there's no ruling class, have to overlook a whole bunch of institutions, from the social register to the elite universities to, and going to Yale doesn't put you in the ruling class. There's all sorts of Yales at Yale. There are all sorts of Harvards at Harvard, you see. You've got to be in a certain groups and certain coteries, and they're self-recruiting and they know who each other are and they intermarry and they go to the same country clubs and they so forth and so on. Occasionally they recruit an outsider in, a Henry Kissinger or a Ziggy Brzezinski or somebody like that who writes the papers and does things for them. There's a gentleman who stood up over there before. Yeah.
Capitalism has been responsible for world wars and trade wars and a national phenomenon. And I'm wondering, is it spreading itself? What is its weakness? Is it a Achilles heel? Is it terminal competition? What kind of problems might you face?
Well, there are a number of empires that have fallen because the patricians will bleed the center to reinforce the peripheries, to pursue far-off plunder. And certainly we see that tendency happening here, that that most definitely we're running into certain kinds of problems. I notice it with the students when I go around universities. They're not as gung-ho as they were a few years ago. You know, yuppie, Reagan, get rich. They're a little more skeptical. They're beginning to see that they that the jobs aren't out there, and and that real wages are going down, and a lot of other people. I don't think there's going to be a crash, but certainly there is a deterioration. And the empire costs an awful lot of money. Sort of, in a way, you see, we're all linked, finally. I mean, they can bleed us, but after a while, if you bleed and starve your own base, your apex will come down. I mean, it's all connected. My friend Saul Lando tells us about how, you know, he had a bad sprain in his neck. He went to a Chinese acupuncturist, and this has become my favorite story. I'm telling it too often, but if don't stop me if you heard it, but he went to the acupuncturist, and the acupuncturist, Chinese acupuncturist, put a needle in his elbow and one in the hand over here, one in his leg. And he said, wait a minute, I don't get the connection. He said, I got a bad neck and you're sticking needles in my elbow and my leg. What's the connection? And the acupuncturist said, whole body connected. Take a look. You know? And And the whole world connected. Take a look. Whole society connected. Take a look. And the essence of capitalism is that it's very opportunistic. It doesn't take a look. It plunders, it destroys the ecology for profits. It will reduce the species of seeds we have that are available, as some people were talking recently, because it then can control these seeds and charge you $3 for a little tomato package with only 11 seeds in it. That's a datum I just got tonight from someone who's involved in organic farming. And they'll do all that. They don't care what happens to the ecology, to the level of oxygen or CO2 in the air, all that. And so the question is whether or not democratic forces can somehow stop this kind of power before it takes us all down. The other question is, might they not be creating such terrible forces as to awaken people and frighten people to take kinds of some actions? That's happened, by the way, just in recent years. We saw people across the political spectrum, including Republicans and others, joining the nuclear freeze movement, a feeling that the whole thing was getting totally out of hand, that it was going crazy. So that, you see, people do at some point, when they're pushed to the edge, may finally see what their interests are and begin to move. And our job is to hope and to work to make sure that when they move left and not right. They don't start moving and blaming the Jews and blaming the this and joining some Klan group and other aberrational things that offer them irrelevant foes and irrelevant enemies, but that they move and see who their real enemies are and who's really doing it to all of us. Because we're all connected with this. yes, sir. Let's take the gentleman.
Yeah, you said you don't see an economic crash, but I wonder if you could elaborate why that is and what prospects do you see of the state possibly resorting to over-fascism.
Well, it doesn't have to. It protects itself by fascism comes. My study of fascism in Italy and Germany leads me to the conclusion that fascism comes because of unresolvable contradictions in the capitalist system. It has nothing to do with the threat of the left. The fascists were paraded and they were financed and supported by the capitalists in Italy and in Germany to destroy the left, but the left was never strong enough to take state power in Italy and Germany. But the left was strong enough to defend its standard of living to some degree. And when the contradictions of capitalism reach the point where their profit levels are dropping, where they have to cut back and roll back wages to increase their profits, where they have to cut back on inheritance taxes and do all these things, cut back on income taxes, all that was done under fascism. Now, the interesting thing is that Ronald Reagan did those things. Reagan's agenda was his political economic agenda was almost identical to Mussolini's and Hitler's. And he did it within the framework of democratic institutions. So as long as they can keep resolving the contradictions and costs of capitalism within that framework of institutions by limiting the vote of the poor, by outspending and spending billions and having their candidate, only rich people can run for office, so forth, and doing that sort of thing, by stacking the judiciary with federal judges who are changing the rules of the game, who are changing those rules. Not just, I don't want to say just, but not just the bad decisions they'll make for women and blacks, minorities and labor, but also the rules of the game themselves, that is the nature of the democracy itself, are being reinterpreted away by these right-wing judges. So while they do that, this is the way they do it, you see. And with a lot of force, they use fascist elements at times. They use political assassination. That's true. I believe they assassinated President Kennedy. I believe they assassinated Robert Kennedy. I believe they assassinated Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. These guys, unless it's just coincidence theory again, it's just some nuts always pick a particular person at a particular stage doing something. But I am firmly convinced in my reading of those cases, and a lot of other people, the assassination of Black Panthers, Fred Hampton, who was doing wonderful work with street gangs and linking them up. When those gangs stopped shooting each other up with guns and themselves with needles and started getting politicized, it was time to destroy the Black Panthers. That's why it's time to keep drugs coming in free and open now, because that's doing the job. So they have all those methods short of fascism or with some crypto quasi-fascist things they're doing. At the same time, you know, they also at times have to give ground, give a little to keep a lot, and this doesn't mean we should give up all electoral strategies. There are struggles that should still go on with elections. There are struggles that should go on with popular demonstrations, and we should continue to struggle. All the more reason we should. Yeah, gentleman in the plaid shirt.
What do you think are the tendencies for us independent?
Well, I think there are real inter-capitalist rivalries. It's really not true that they have internationalized to the point where it's all one thing. When push comes to shove, General Motors will say to you, they're no longer an American company, they're an international company. Sure. They don't want to be subjected to American laws or the laws of any country. They're above any country. General Motors would like you to know that they are above. But when push comes to shove and they want their interests defended, they don't go to the French Foreign Legion or to the Japanese Home Defense Force. They go to the U.S. What you have is a situation where the Japanese are paying very little of the global overhead costs of global capitalism, and the U.S. leaders are in kind of a fix about that, because on the one hand they want the Japanese to pay more. I mean, the U.S. capitalists are paying, or the U.S. nation is paying the costs, right? We pay the military overhead costs in the Philippines. The Japanese are investing big in the Philippines. We pay in Indonesia with the CIA and whatever else, and the generals there, they're totally supported by the U.S., and the Japanese are bigger than we are in Indonesia as far as money. So the question comes up is, hey, we're picking up the bill for this world global empire, and you're getting the benefits. On the other hand, they don't want the Japanese to rearm. I mean, a Japan that was as militarily strong as it is economically strong would really, that would make a whole new ball game. It would be very interesting what it might lead to. So they say to the Japanese, well, you got to pick up some of the non-military costs, which the Japanese are doing now. I mean, some, you know, the foreign aid stuff, the infrastructure, build the roads from the latifundios to the refineries to the seaports and all that. So they're resolving their problems. I'm not one of those who believes that the thing just collapses on its own internal contradictions or it's in a state of crisis. We've been hearing that for 200 years, how it's in a state of crisis. But they do, you know, they have ways of developing new techniques and whatever else, and new accommodations for each other. And they learn from experience, too. They learn very costly sometimes to the rest of us. I'm not going to hear from any more men. I would like to see a woman's hand go up. Yes?
Do you know anything about the state of civil order in Panama? I heard that when they lift the political prisoners out, they also released a lot of the ordinary criminals and that they were running to these wildlands. And I was wondering if you know anything about that.
I had heard that, but I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm sure they're setting up death squads in Panama. I'm sure they're doing it in Nicaragua right now too. Yes, ma'am.
We wrote letters to our congressmen saying that we didn't like our tax money being spent on the death squad government in El Salvador. And we got back some interesting replies. Most of them said that it was a democratic government that we were supporting, and that the rebels were being armed by the Soviets, and therefore we didn't defend against this communist aggression. And one of them said that the letter was being turned over to the State Department, and that made us wonder if we needed to start launching the Soviets.
Wait, what happened? One of them said what?
That the letter was going to be turned over to the State Department.
Mm-hmm. Well, respond. The question was that some people have been writing letters to Congress people, and they've been getting interesting responses, like We have to fight in a, why are we spending our money for death squads in El Salvador? And they say we have to fight in El Salvador because the rebels are armed by the Soviets and we're defending democracy there. And one of the members of Congress said that he was sending the letter to the State Department. And you asked, should we respond to that? Well, you write to him and say, if we're capable of writing to the State Department ourselves, we want you to think about it, and you're the one who's supposed to be making policy. Sometimes you shouldn't be so gracious in your responses. You know, when you're speaking to these people, you should really push them back. I mean, being nice guys all the time. I got a letter some time ago from a snot-nosed student from some school. He said, really smirky snicker. I can see him sitting with his fraternity friends giggling over the writing of the letter. He said, dear Mr. Parenti, we're using your book Democracy for the Few in our course, and on page such and such, you say that the secret to getting rich is not to work hard, but to get other people to work hard for you. And he says, I think that's very good advice, and I would like very much to get other people to work hard for me to get rich off their labor. Do you have any suggestions as to what are the ways in which I could probably exploit other people, because I would like to get rich as soon as possible? And he signed his name, Ted something. So I just mailed his letter back to him, and I wrote on the bottom, I said, dear Ted, some asshole sent me this letter and signed your name to it, and I sent it back to you. Now that wasn't the response he was expecting, you know. And I tell you, I'm very tired. If you don't mind, I want to end on a happy note there. Thank you.